power, money, violence, ideology. These factors combine together in societies experiencing intractable conflict. Today we ask what this means for politics, the state, and how public authorities function. We show how societies prone to violence also tend to have a particular way of doing politics, buying and selling support and loyalty as if it's a marketplace, and foreign influence, foreign money, and indeed Western financial systems are a big part of this story. So how do we break this terrible cycle of money and war?
We save the government, they show their gratitude.
You get rich, right?
Two British men are accused of going into business with a warlord who recruited child soldiers.
The UN estimates 300,000 people were killed.
Every government who came to the power said they will fight the corruption and they will eliminate it.
Welcome to Conflict Zone from the LSC with me, Azaria Morgan, and my co-producer, Luke Cooper.
In this podcast, we explore what happens when politics becomes a question of buying and selling support, when the economic opportunities presented by politics are greater than those of economics. One result is that societies can become prone to outbreaks of violence between groups competing in what we can call a political marketplace. This concept has been developed by Alex DeWall on the Conflict Research Programme to make sense of the connections between state authority, the global economic system, and the persistence of violence. By the end of this podcast, you'll gain an insight into the problem that political marketplaces represent to democratic peace building, the role of financial globalization as an opportunity network for corrupt activity, and the specific ways in which these problems have been manifested in Somalia, Sudan, and South Sudan.
The last two decades have been the champagne era for dirty lucre.
Millions have been displaced while rival leaders fight for power and the country's oil and mineral wealth.
Corruption and bureaucracy are preventing the country from making progress.
Part 1. What is a political marketplace? From Sudan under al-Bashir to a broader application.
Like the other conceptual frameworks we use on the Conflict Research Programme, the idea of the political marketplace is based on experience. Our empirical research exploring sites of conflict in Central Africa, the Horn of Africa, and the Middle East identifies the key recurring features in intractable conflict situations. By diagnosing these conditions, we hope to find democratic pathways out of situations of extreme conflict. Alex DeWall is research professor at Tufts University and director of the World Peace Foundation. He developed the concept of the political marketplace through his research amongst elites in Sudan.
Back in 2005-2006, I joined the African Union mediation team to try to resolve the conflict in Darfur. And we were meeting in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, in a small, rather pokey hotel on the outskirts of the city. And the main meetings took place in the converted dining hall of the hotel around a square table. And the mediators were sitting at one end, the government of Sudan delegation on one side, the rebels on the other side, and the internationals at the far end. And these meetings were slow and extraordinarily tedious. And I began to wonder what is really going on here, because it seems clear to me that the actual proceedings in the plenary discussions were not the main event. They were a distraction from something else that was going on. I started hanging around in the corridors and the rooms and just chatting with the different delegates. And it soon became clear to me that the task that had been given to the chief mediator from the government of Sudan's side, who was a physician and trade unionist who had become a senior political figure, Majzoub al-Khalifa, who as well as the chief mediator for Darfur, was also responsible for organizing the election campaign for the ruling National Congress Party. It became clear to me that his brief was less to achieve a workable peace agreement with the rebels and more to try and bring them round to his side on a one-by-one basis. The rebels themselves, the Darfurian people, called it Jalaba politics, the Jalaba being the small itinerant retailers who traditionally used to roam the Sudanese peripheries selling salt and matches and cigarettes, who came from the trading class from the Nile. And when I began to talk to Magzoub about this, he was remarkably candid. The terms he used were, he said, I have a political budget or political pocket, the money that is there to buy off these individuals. And the going rate depends upon the state of the market. Who else is bidding in the market? So that if the Chadians or the Libyans were also buying up loyalties, the price would go up. And he was complaining that the presence of the Americans had led the rebels to overprice themselves. And so this was really the insight, the origins of the insight. And my thinking was that if these are the terms that the elite themselves use in describing what is going on, as an anthropologist, the first thing I should be doing is saying, okay, this is their description. How far does it go? And one of the things I did then in my ongoing work with the African Union, which involved helping to facilitate the negotiations over the independence of South Sudan, was I went to see the then head of security, General Salah Ghosh, who is a rather intimidating character. And to break the ice, I cracked what I thought was a joke. I said, you know, what's the price of a militia in Darfur this week? How does it compare to the price of a militia in South Sudan? And to my surprise, he gave me the answer, and he explained, again in rather frank detail, how the prices were going up and down, and how the southerners were, in his view, misreading the market. And when I spoke to his counterparts in the south, they were very, very candid that, yes, this was how politics was being conducted, but they themselves also had a counter-narrative, a narrative of liberation from the political marketplace.
Omar al-Bashir came to power in a coup in 1989. He relied heavily on Islamism to legitimize his rule. In 1998, al-Bashir clashed with the Clinton administration when they bombed suspected al-Qaeda sites in Sudan and Afghanistan.
Today, I ordered our armed forces to strike at terrorist-related facilities in Afghanistan and Sudan.
So it is testament to the political agility of al-Bashir that despite these tensions, he ruled Sudan for nearly three decades before falling from power amidst democratic mass protests in early 2019. In 1992, al-Bashir had founded the National Congress Party, which went on to become the ruling party and a critical dealmaker in the political marketplace. However, the origins of the political marketplace in Sudan precede al-Bashir's rule.
The marketization of Sudanese politics began in the 1970s, and it began as a process whereby the principles of supply and demand were applied to politics, were transferred from the commercial arena, from simple corruption, into actually the supply and demand provision of basic political services, political loyalties, security, banking, political campaigning. And that marketization process proceeded apace in the 1980s. Initially, the plan that Bashir had was to push back against this, was to enact an Islamist revolution that would bring about an Islamic state, an authoritarian state that would reject the past in Sudan. But the Islamists had themselves been masters of the marketization of politics. The Islamic banks had been set up and run with an aim to purchasing loyalty of different constituencies and monetizing politics. And as the Sudanese state was itself bankrupt at the time, very quickly the Islamists turned to the marketplace principle for how they ran Sudanese politics. And at the same time, they enhanced what had become the mercenarization of counterinsurgency, when the government was bankrupt in the 1980s, to run the counterinsurgencies against the SPLA in the south and in the Nuba Mountains. They turned to renting militia, creating militia out of tribal groups, and initially rewarding them with loot, and then systematizing this into the marketization of counterinsurgency and pacification. And so this became the modus operandi of the government. And when Sudan became an oil exporter at the end of the 1990s, and the money available to the government increased massively because of the oil rents, those oil rents were then instrumentalized for the purposes of consolidating the control of Bashir and his closest clique over politics in northern Sudan and providing sufficient resources to buy the southern rebels, the SPLA, into the political system.
Political marketplace societies are prone to violence. Sudan has experienced one of the longest civil wars in history, with almost continuous conflict in the south, a factor in al-Bashir's original seizure of power. In 2011, this led to the formation of South Sudan as an independent state, but the country has also experienced conflict in the western region of Darfur too. Al-Bashir was actually indicted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity in the Darfur conflict. In 2009, he loudly condemned the International Court and stressed his role in Sudanese development.
Their goal is to stop development in Sudan. They're trying to distract us, to keep us distracted with their cases and their accusations, but we will not be distracted.
But Sudan's record in development was poor, and economic troubles would be a factor in al-Bashir's eventual downfall. Political marketplaces are prone to violence because the organization of violence can be a mechanism to secure negotiating power in the market. This is what Alex de Waal calls a free market, with many competing actors and weak central authority.
A free market where pretty much anyone can enter, where the price can shift from day to day. And we saw that, let's say, in Darfur 15 years ago. At the time when I was beginning to understand how this worked, where you had essentially a gig economy of the organization of war, where a small operator deep in the rural areas could assemble a small team with a couple of land cruisers mounted with heavy weapons and have a Thuraya phone and some cell phones and could organize a few military operations, could shoot up a marketplace, hijack a few trucks, kill a few policemen, and send a message to political patrons in Khartoum or in Jamaica or Tripoli, I'm here, pay me off. Or could get together with his peers, a few others, to mount a bigger operation and then enter the political market and grow in size. And so that kind of free market, it tends to be a transient phenomenon, but we saw it in Darfur in the late 2000s. We saw it in parts of opposition-controlled Syria shortly after the revolution when Gulf donors from Qatar, from Saudi Arabia, and also donors from security agents from the United States were fishing for clients.
But a strong central state does not mean the absence of a political marketplace. They can also exist in what Alex calls centralized kleptocracies, highly corrupt, transactional, but unitary states.
Where you have one key actor who has a pretty good grip on the market and can actually operate as a monopolist and set the prices and can determine who can enter the market, can actually set the barriers to entry. And so we have a country like Egypt or like Syria before the outbreak of the war, where you have a central actor that controls pretty much everything, and it resembles an institutionalized state, but it's run on a fairly corporate set of principles. So family relations, bribery, payoffs are pretty central to the way the state is run.
A further type mixes elements of these extremes.
In between, we have what is perhaps the most characteristic form of the political marketplace, which is an oligopoly, domination by a handful of key operators who maybe collude or maybe they are rivals. And what we see quite often in many of these countries is no single one dominant player, but perhaps a segmentation of the market. So in Iraq, for example, the market in Basra operates really quite differently to the market in Kurdistan. They have different players that will not encroach upon one another's territory. And a similar deregulation of the market, but again with a cluster of key players that tend to work to try to control the market among themselves.
Part 2, Global Capitalism, the Developmental State and the Political Marketplace.
Global capitalism has been through several stages, and one of them is often referred to as the era of globalization. There are many debates around how exactly to define this very contested term, but one simple definition is to see it as a period of economic restructuring that opened in the Western world in the 1970s and internationalized in the 1990s with the fall of the communist states. A big feature of this new era of capitalism is the ease with which money can move across borders, sometimes called financial liberalization. This has made it much easier to hide the proceeds of money and corruption. Financial secrecy combined with financial liberalization has created large global criminal networks, often with overlapping relationships to states and conflict zones. Domestic political marketplaces function as part of this global integrated network. Aditya Sarka is a researcher at the World Peace Foundation, Tufts University.
In general, political marketplaces tend to be poorer countries in a subordinate position in the world economic order. And what I mean by that is that they're exposed to economic currents and shocks beyond their control. The utility of the political marketplace in the analysis of conflict is to break it down into a series of questions around political budget, which is the amount of money available to rulers, buy services, buy loyalty, and personally enrich themselves. The price of loyalty, which is the kind of price commanded by elites in return for providing services. And the way in which money and the use of money and the use of violence are interrelated.
Alex de Waal describes these vulnerabilities to violence as in part a product of these states' position within the periphery of global capitalism.
In conventional thinking, countries like Sudan, Somalia, Congo, Yemen are seen as fragile states. They are states that have in some way become interrupted in their progress of state formation by various external setbacks and so on. I think it's much more productive to see these states as moving in a different direction entirely, as moving in the direction of the more thoroughgoing marketization of politics. They are states that are situated at the margins of the world capitalist order. And the next stage in the development of the political marketplace theory occurred for me in a series of seminars that were in Addis Ababa. What happened was that the then Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Meles Zenawi, was embarked upon a very well theorized and very bold experiment in building what he called the democratic developmental state in Ethiopia. Now, I think there are obviously very serious questions about whether it was democratic, but there's no doubt that it was developmental. And he brought in a number of intellectuals and thinkers, a small group, but we were about half a dozen. Amongst us were the current Prime Minister of Sudan, Abdallah Hamdok, to discuss his theory of the developmental state and the challenges to it. And I made the argument that actually he needed to take much more seriously the threats to his developmental project that came from the principle of the political marketplace. And he very quickly fastened on to this as what he described as an up-to-date contemporary explanation of the paradigmatic African state, where neoliberalism, the commodification of social relations, had entered the political realm. So a new form of neo-patrimonialism suited to the turbulent, globalized era. And he described it very candidly for Somalia and for some of the peripheries of Ethiopia. And he began to also argue and recognize that the principal threat to his developmental project in Ethiopia came from the marketization of political relationships that was occurring worldwide, driven by, to some extent, the United States, also by some of the powers in the Middle East, the Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, which had a very transactional and monetized approach to politics. His greatest fear, his nightmare scenario for Ethiopia, was that Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates would come together with a common agenda of controlling the Horn of Africa, using a combination of their enormous financial power and their access to policymakers in Washington, D.C. And I think, disastrously, that scenario has actually now come to pass in Ethiopia.
This concept of the development state with institutional capacity and strong public authority represents an important alternative to the political marketplace.
A developmental state, or any institutionalized state, is one that more or less resembles the legal, rational, bureaucratic state as envisaged by Max Weber. And most theories of state formation and state fragility essentially see the functioning of a state, or as a fragile state, as a state that is in some way deficient. They identify primarily its failings to live up to the institutionalized ideal model. Now, this has been critiqued by many as overlooking how these states actually function. And one of the dominant paradigms for that is to see these states as neo-patrimonial in some way. But there's a great tendency among political scientists to use very static frameworks for analyzing how these countries function. So even in their critique of state formation and state building, political scientists and anthropologists revert to other formulae for explaining the functioning of states that don't take into account one of the most characteristic features of these countries, which I would call turbulence. Turbulence being the way in which there is an unpredictability to real politics, the way in which the members of the political elite conduct their political transactions, conduct their everyday politics, meaning that there are changes from week to week, but nonetheless, the fundamental structure remains the same. There's an old joke in Sudan, which is politics there changes every week, but you come back after 5 years and it's exactly the same. And it's commonplace to note, let's say, a junior diplomat arriving in Khartoum, or for that matter in Juba, and getting very excited about all the changes that are happening and writing code cables and reports and saying, oh, there are these exciting changes happening. There's really a breakthrough about to happen. A peace process is really going to happen. There's some real commitment to change. And then 5 years later, when that diplomat leaves the position, actually, a rather downbeat assessment. Actually, the fundamental problems haven't been resolved. And time and again, we see in UN reports or reports from the Foreign Office or European Union or USAID, oh, there's just a lack of political will. There was a real intention to change things, but it somehow didn't happen. So my premise in the political marketplace is actually that's just how it is. And it ain't going to change because people have a bit more political will. What happens is this constant churning, this turmoil, this turbulence, this repeated moments of hope and then relapse, that's just how it functions. And if you're an aid donor, you can identify a bubble of integrity. Maybe there's an individual who, in a rather inspiring way, has got a unit within the Ministry of Health or within the judiciary or finance or a particular army unit that is emerging as a model of probity and effectiveness and looking very much like the sorts of institutions we like to work with in Western countries. But circumstances change. That individual moves on to a different position. That individual is promoted and comes under a different set of pressures, and that bubble bursts. So it's not as though these bubbles of integrity are the way of the future. They are just transient phenomena which, yeah, do deliver real public goods in those particular circumstances. But the actual real driver is somewhere else. And if we begin to think of these countries in marketplace terms, we understand that, as in a market, supply and demand, fluctuations in prices, small producers entering or leaving the market, consolidation, bankruptcy. These are just the way that the market functions on a day-to-day basis, and so too with the political arena.
Part 3, taking a closer look, the political marketplace in Somalia.
By any criteria, Somalia is a troubled society with a troubled modern history. It is one of the most drought-vulnerable countries in the world and was hit by severe food insecurity between 2015 and 2017. It has been in arrears to the International Monetary Fund for more than 30 years and has the sixth highest poverty rate in the world. This marks Somalia out firmly as a state on the periphery of the world capitalist system.
With little or no government services, widespread unemployment and lack of job opportunities, the rural population is in dire straits.
I earn between $2 to $3 a day.
Exposure and vulnerability to economic shocks is an important factor in the development of organised violence in political marketplaces. Youth unemployment stands at 67% in Somalia. The growth of militias able to make claims on the political marketplace finds in this pool of young people many potential recruits. Aditya Sarkar describes Somalia as a consummate political marketplace society. He warns against viewing the country's difficulties through, as many do, the lens of clan conflict.
Somalia is almost a paradigmatic case of a political marketplace, and it's a very open and a very violent political marketplace. What I mean by that is that there are a lot of actors who are involved in Somalia. There are a lot of sources of influence, sources of finance, which come in and out of the Somali space. And using the political marketplace to analyze Somalia means that we move away from the framework of seeing Somalia purely as a clan-based conflict. Scholars have done this for a while. They've used different explanations for studying Somalia. But amongst policymakers, the clan conflict framework remains dominant. So every time policymakers go out to discuss Somalia or to think about interventions in Somalia, they think about it through the lens of clan conflict. And the political marketplace helps shift that conversation, because clan conflict doesn't fit with the empirical reality of how conflict in Somalia has played out, neither the history nor how it is constructed today. Somalia's economy is extremely vulnerable to climate disaster, outbreak of disease amongst livestock, fluctuations in global food prices, and so on and so forth. And years of war have left it with a really well-developed private sector, especially in mobile money, remittance handling, and telecoms, but a private sector which is dominated by cartels. So its governance institutions are dysfunctional, and fiscal and financial authorities in particular are weak and extremely corrupt. And it suffers disproportionately from the effects of tax evasion and the theft of state assets. Within this broader framework, politics is highly transactional. And it has been since the Siad Barre era in the 1970s and 80s, mostly since the 1980s.
Army General Siad Barre seized power in a coup in 1969 and ruled Somalia as a dictator until 1991. His emphasis on socialist economic policies won him support from the Soviet Union. But his bid to create a greater Somalia, the goal of overturning the borders dictated by the old colonial empires, and uniting Somali populations in the Horn of Africa, led him to war with the then socialist regime in Ethiopia, leading eventually to the loss of Soviet patronage. The origins of the political marketplace in Somalia lie in this period.
Siad Barre used geostrategic rents, first from the Soviet Union and then from the United States, aid resources, humanitarian support for refugees, etc., to keep his regime intact, to stay in power, if you will, at a time when his power was being severely challenged. And he used these resources strategically to play off different localized rivalries, to incite clans against one another, and to make sure that there was no single player which was powerful enough to oppose him or to overthrow him. Of course, this didn't succeed, and in 1991 he failed. But what you see today in Somalia is something similar, where the Somali federal government is only one of the players in the political marketplace. It's a very powerful player, especially now, because it has the backing of international actors and various other actors from the Middle East, including Turkey and Qatar, or allegedly so, at least. But at the same time, it is unable to simply impose its will on all regions of Somalia, which is why you have this really complex political relationship between the government in Mogadishu, the different regional leaders in the different sort of federal regions of Somalia. And of course, the government's power is held up by AMISOM, and Al-Shabaab is a significant player in the market.
Aditya Sarkar argues the war in Ethiopia was critical to the emergence of the Somalian political marketplace.
The way we've always tried to do a political marketplace analysis is to look at its emergence in history by looking at specific points, critical junctures, points of rupture, where the system of governance is reorganized and reconstituted and specifically commoditized. Now, if you look at the history of Somalia, and in particular Siad Barre's regime, you can identify the point of rupture as the Ogaden War, where Siad Barre fought a war with neighboring Ethiopia over the Ogaden region. And it was a disastrous war, especially because the Soviet Union switched support midway through the war. And Siad Barre was routed. And what this meant was that he then became obsessed with the need to coup-proof his regime, because he anticipated correctly that there were going to be multiple challenges to his authority. But of course, the difficulty was that Somalia was a really open economic system. The primary source of revenue flowing through the Somali economic system was not money flowing up to the government, but it was actually remittances and localized small-scale trading. So money which couldn't be easily used by the government, by Siad Barre's regime, to dominate the political system. So what he started doing was using geostrategic rents and violence very strategically to manipulate a number of local rivalries which had already existed.
These politically and economically generated local rivalries would over time create the conditions for a breakdown of public authority. By far and away the most well-known of the country's armed operators in the Somali political marketplace is Al-Shabaab, the militant Islamist group. In 2012, Al-Shabaab declared its allegiance to Al-Qaeda. 1 year later, a Channel 4 film crew gained access to areas under their control. A representative of the group defended the targeting of innocent civilians.
Why target civilians rather than the military? Kenya attacked us. We have said many times, stay away from us. Leave our land, our people. Stop fighting us. We warned them again and again, but they ignored us. So we have to spill blood to send a message.
This extremist rhetoric should not blind us to the ways in which the organisation has been a successful player in the system of violent patronage that is the Somali political marketplace. Al-Shabaab has been engaged in conflict with AMISOM, the African Union mission in Somalia, the international military force stationed in the country since 2007, as well as the Somali government. But the emergence of a violent, open, and competitive political marketplace was a long-term phenomenon in Somalia. This makes for a contrast with Syria and Iraq, where violent marketplaces formed very rapidly.
Faced with a kind of stalemate in the war, the amount of money flowing into Syria and especially to the opposition groups, meant that there was an extraordinary proliferation and mushrooming of opposition groups, which were constantly both competing and colluding with each other for access to these finances and for access to control of things like checkpoints and parts of the war economy. And then that shift changed again. The market structure changed again as sources of finance became more consolidated, as external actors began to support specific groups. It's an interesting case where you see the influence of external funders as being critical to shaping marketplace dynamics. It is certainly different to some of the cases in the Horn of Africa, where the commoditization of politics actually took place over a longer term.
Part 4. Civil society resistance to the political marketplace. The overthrow of al-Bashir.
Following a series of mass protests, Sudan's dictator of 30 years, Omar al-Bashir, was removed by the country's military leadership.
After 30 years in power, President Omar al-Bashir has been forced out of power by the country's military.
The process of civil society revolution, elite adaptation to the new realities, and a military coup d'etat has some parallels to the Egyptian revolution in 2011. From the outset, civil society were alert to these dangers.
Nothing has changed. There's nothing new. We were demanding the complete change of the regime and government, but they just replaced one guy with another. We're calling for someone, a son of Sudan, to re-establish this country and this ruined economy and infrastructure. But they did nothing for us, so we're staying in the streets.
Rajal Makawi is a civil society activist from Sudan. She joined social movement protests after finishing her university studies, having found no avenue for her democratic political views in Sudanese institutional politics.
Like many of my age, I was inducted into the civic resistance scene through university politics. At the time, the previous regime's airtight restrictions on political activity necessitated that a separation between student activism and public discourses be in place. As a result, politically active and motivated youth graduated into the political landscape with a political agenda that mismatches the institutional realities of our respective parties. And as a result, we then had no space to be absorbed but into civil society. This is perhaps why it is difficult to pin a single identification or agenda to the civil society as it stands, more so during and in the aftermath of the revolution.
Civil society has been given a position in the transitional process in Sudan. Following popular pressure in the summer of 2019, a transitional agreement was struck. A government of unity was formed as a step towards elections scheduled for 2022.
What I've noted in the past few months, given the prominent role and space assigned to civil society in influencing the trajectory of Sudan's post-revolutionary political developments, is that the unified vision among the many competing factions that make up its various sectors is impossible. And while that might be in itself a virtue of these kinds of socio-political structures, we also need to consider the nature of these evolutions in relation to how a contracting and defunded state relinquishes its responsibilities to an unelected enclave of donor-dependent Western-oriented elites whose failure to respond to the political collective is almost at par as that of, the failed state.
As societies within the peripheries of global capitalism, political marketplace states are vulnerable to financial shocks in international markets. Like Somalia, Sudan is also notable as a country in arrears to the IMF. The adverse conditions that follow from this have required civil society to step in as a way of delivering basic public services.
With structural adjustment programs in Sudan as in other places, as the state started to contract in terms of provision of services, education, health, and whatever else, this then just naturally meant an expansion of civil society to take over that neglected space. So this is what defines the new phase of civil society.
Civil society movements face a daunting challenge aiming to bring about democracy in Sudan. But they are starting from a strong foundation with a layer of activists demonstrating what we call on the conflict research programme civicness, a democratic horizon for grassroots organising efforts.
This mass protest was preceded by numerous episodes of small-scale and violent unrests breaking out throughout the country in different periods over the last 10 years. I think it would be difficult to pinpoint them all in order to understand the intricate and interconnected nature of the development in the country's recent political profile. However, if these were to be understood, they could have possibly predicted the revolution, as well as the end of the Bashir regime, and the unfavorable current conditions that are a product of a weak transitional leadership controlled by the old guard. This particular mass movement or revolution, built on the back of many uprising incidents, is an accumulation of resistance. It should be understood as an accumulation of resistance. In the case of Sudan, it responds to an accumulation as well of state violations, which in themselves are a product of a predatory capitalist system that's progressing into more volatile stages in response to the regional international developments on the international economic stage. So kind of, you know, Sudan kind of is integrated into this massive global economic grid in unfavorable terms. And the political developments on the ground kind of reflect the volatility of those, you know, capitalist transactions. I think in the case of the 2008 revolution, there are a number of remarkable features that serve the strategic evolution of its success. And this is why it's unique. So from the day it erupted in December until the fall of the Bashir regime in April, which is a considerable time, if you come to think of it, 5 months of, you know, consistent resistance, when you consider, obviously, the amount of state repression that was welded on society that struggles to maintain its daily food security is quite something. So the features or the points to kind of consider that makes the Sudanese revolution what it is first of all, the barracking off of the neighborhoods, which then became the locus from which organizational operations were launched and run. And now, because the neighborhoods themselves were infiltrated with state agents, the effort and organizational technique that went into isolating those agents, while at the same time developing trusted networks to communicate and execute the daily activities of resistance, wasn't honestly anything short of miraculous. And with it also was born a new, let's say, people's political manifesto of organization, one that probably at the moment supersedes that of the Communist Party and the labor unions, you know, as a representative of left politics. Now, the importance of this step in setting up the ground for the continuity of the revolution and revolutionary resistance that culminated in the fall of al-Bashir and his cronies was that this step managed to effectively mobilize the country's youth into one vast national network, where almost a year after, while they continue to lend a measured rope to the transitional government, have also used this precious time to develop a common civic platform where social demands in the name of citizenship are being formulated. The neighborhood committees of youth, in my opinion, are the Sudanese revolution's enduring legacy. Another point to consider is the development of a people's leadership, one with a considerable distance from the old political guard and their parties. Basically, now we're talking about the Sudanese Professional Association. They are a progressive, labor-based, middle-class social group, which managed to create a synergy with the popular masses during the revolution to formulate a resistance agenda.
The legacy of the Sudanese revolution lies in the transformation in the position of young people.
One of the most important achievements of the Sudanese revolution is that a public political discourse on rights is being formulated with the youth at its helm. Youth are using the newfound freedoms and the new opened up space to make political gains. I'm particularly optimistic about what this means for the future of Sudanese civil society. Because if these grassroots demand-based groups, whose concern is to find a relationship or to communicate a relationship between labor and capital, and how this relationship shapes social rights, if they are institutionalized in the place of their internationally funded liberal counterparts, then we'll start to see a more viable social contract developing, where a larger social base is integrated in a meaningful way.
A central problem that this movement faces is the violent political marketplace and fragmented authority.
The disruption of public order and the country descending into chaos is a very realistic probability. And we're talking about a country where beyond the center, almost all its frontiers and peripheries are conflict-ridden, with at least thousands of different rebel factions infighting amongst each other and with the state. So the probability of this descending into something much more problematic is a real possibility. The nature of political inclusion doesn't always include the more progressive option of civicness, or it cannot be delivered through the progressive option of civicness all the time. Consider how Darfur, one example of Sudan's many contested regions, has in the scope of 20 years been transformed into a conflict zone proper. Its economy is that of war. This is at a time when unsuccessful peace processes continue to be led even by the new transitional government. But no breakthroughs have been made. So the new terms proposed could possibly alienate rebel groups and warring factions whose terms of reference are more familiar with the legacy of divide and rule as opposed to meaningful power-sharing arrangements. However, demands and pressure groups born out of youth organizations or youth organizing activities that started with the neighborhood committees, with them we start seeing a more organized and world social justice agenda that is at its core socioeconomic, rather than just political. Now, these groups have been instrumental in leading new and versatile understandings of corruption, with the aim of protecting the revolution's game from even the new political elite. So while the new elite at the helm of the new transitional government came to power with a predefined idea of what corruption is, basically mostly defined or associated with the previous regime and its cronies' wealth, what they did is they tried to establish a link between that particular type of corruption, which has to do with dismantling the old regime, and wealth redistribution.
Sudanese activists expressed concerns that while the new government has taken steps to liquidate assets of members of the al-Bashir regime and use them for social spending, this hasn't involved sufficient engagement with the structural reforms needed to break the international financial logics of the political marketplace.
For anyone who understands the political economy or how political economy works, you must realize that you can't fund public sector salaries from assets that you've liquidated at the end of a particular regime, because, I mean, that money, that source is going to kind of dry up at some point. And unless you find ways to be more productive, to continue to kind of support and expand your social upward mobility of your middle classes, then it's not going to be sustainable.
Events in Sudan are particularly important for supporters of democratic transition. Liberals and Democrats globally will be hoping that the country can avoid the trajectory of most of the Arab Spring countries that failed to realise the promise of revolutionary democratic change. To be successful, civil society movements will need to undertake a true transformation of the state, creating a new public authority with strong institutions and democratic legitimacy. Something akin to a democratic developmental state. In the next episode, we explore the dangers political marketplaces pose for how ideology is manifested, their strong tendency towards identity politics, by which we mean the insistence on monolithic and divisive sectarian, ethnic, or religious identities. For now, that concludes today's podcast on the concept of the political marketplace. We hope you found it informative and educational. You can find more information on the Conflict Research Programme at the LSE website. Just put LSE Conflict Research Programme into your search engine and it will come up. You can find details on the site of upcoming events, videos of previous ones, and links to all our publications. You can also follow us on Twitter at LSE_CCS. See you next time.